I want to start this section of Chapter 3 with the notion of a scrutometer. Scrutometer is a made-up word. It was actually made up by a political science professor of mine in graduate school. But I think it really nicely captures the way the Supreme Court looks at laws that regulate speech. What the Supreme Court tends to do under the idea of scrutometers is it determines what kind of law a law is. Is it content-based or content-neutral? And it applies the appropriate level of scrutiny. Let me explain. A content-based regulation regulates speech because of what it says. For example, hate speech or fighting words, those are examples of speech that is regulated because of what it says. If the court determines that a law regulates speech because of what it says, the court will apply strict scrutiny. Strict scrutiny has a legal definition, but for our purposes, what's important about it is that it is very difficult for the government to prove that strict scrutiny is, you know, important and relevant. In other words, if a law is content-based, normally that means that the law gets strict scrutiny, and normally that means that the law is unconstitutional. The government has to meet a very high burden of proof for these laws to stand. Now, we're going to see a couple of laws or a couple of situations where the laws have been upheld. For example, some hate ordinances, which are content-based, like a penalty enhancement, are okay because the government has met its burden. But generally speaking, content-based regulations receive strict scrutiny and are usually unconstitutional. I'll say that again. Content-based regulations receive strict scrutiny and are usually unconstitutional. On the other hand, a content-neutral regulation regulates all expression the same, regardless of what it says. So things like noise regulations or time, place, and manner regulations, those sorts of regulations are generally okay because the government only has to meet ordinary or relaxed scrutiny. There just has to be a good relationship between the law and the ordinance. Okay, and there's another area, another level of scrutiny called intermediate scrutiny. It's usually considered for symbolic speech. Let me give you an example of the difference between content-based and content-neutral. Let's say that the university decides that there are too many posters all over campus. They take a look at the posters and they realize that the college Democrats are one of the biggest offenders. They put up a lot of posters. So the university says, all right, we're going to say that the college Democrats cannot put up any posters anymore. Everyone else can put up posters, but the college Democrats can't. That singles out one particular organization for different regulation. The government, in this case the university, would have to meet strict scrutiny, and probably that regulation would be overturned. Now, the university could address the problem in a different way by saying, each student organization gets only 10 posters a semester to put up. So, you know, if there are 100 organizations and they each get 10 posters, well, that's still a lot of posters, but at least they're treating all university organizations the same. That is a content-neutral regulation. We would call that a time, place, and manner regulation, and that would be usually okay because it would only get ordinary scrutiny. It would be reasonable for me to ask you on an exam to identify the difference between a content-based and a content-neutral regulation and what happens to them. So let me give you a question. Let's say that the university decides that, or let's use a public park instead. Let's say that the city of Fullerton has a public park. And in the public park, there's a band shell, you know, a place where bands can play. But there are people who live around the park who think that there's been too much noise. So the university or the public The city takes a look at the park and says, well, the biggest offenders are rock bands. Rock bands tend to be the loudest, so we're going to say that no more rock bands can play in the shell. What sort of regulation is that? Is it content-based or content-neutral? If you're thinking it's content-based, you'd be right. It's singling out rock bands for differential treatment. The level of scrutiny to be applied is strict scrutiny, and probably the law would be overturned. A better way for the city to regulate that form of expression would be to say no matter what kind of music a band is playing, it can only play it at a certain level of sound, a certain number of decibels, and it maybe has to end between 10 o'clock at night, or before 10 o'clock at night. That's a time, place, and manner regulation. It's regulating the time the expression can take place and the manner it can take place. That would receive ordinary or relaxed scrutiny and probably would be constitutional. It would be reasonable for me on an exam to ask you the difference. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about some content-based regulations and about some regulations on expression. Let's start out with fighting words. Fighting words are defined basically as any concept or any words that would cause an average addressee to fight. Now, there are some problems with this, as you're probably already thinking. The case that set it up, however, is Chaplinsky versus New York. It would be a good one for you to know. In this case, Chaplinsky called an official a damned fascist. And the public official, the cop, didn't like it, and so he took a swing at him. Mr. Chaplinsky tried to say that that was protected speech, and the Supreme Court said, no, it's not. Okay? Fighting words are words by which their very utterance inflict injury or tend to cause immediate breach of the peace, and words that are likely to cause the average addressee to fight. Now, you can think of probably in your head some words that would cause you to want to take a swing at someone. If you're a person of color, the N-word might be such a word. Okay? If you're a woman, the C-word might be such a word. Okay? And if you don't know what those are, drop me an email. Okay? Those are words that would likely to cause people to want to get into some sort of altercation. Now, there's a problem with this. Okay? There's a problem of understanding. Now, right now, if I called you a damned fascist, you might kind of take a look at me and say, what? You know, are you trying to insult me? Let me give you another example. Let's say that I approach someone in class and I say, did I just propose marriage? Or did I say I want to beat you up? So there's an understanding issue. It's very contextual. It's very cultural. Okay? As a result, this fighting words doctrine is not a very powerful doctrine because it has so many cultural implications. It's tied so closely to understanding, to culture, to different times in history, but it's still out there and we're still going to see it, so it's important to understand it. Okay, I'm going to talk a little bit about symbolic speech. Symbolic speech is speech that doesn't have words, like burning a draft card, burning a flag, burning a cross. There is an overall test that I'm just going to introduce you to that comes out of the U.S. versus O'Brien case. David O'Brien, that's not him, that's just an example of someone burning a draft card. David O'Brien burned his draft card around the Vietnam War era, and he was convicted under the Selective Service Act. The Selective Service Act said that you had to have a card. All right? He said, well, I burned my card because I hate the war. It's symbolic speech. But his conviction was upheld, and the court came up with a three-part test for it. The court said, if you're going to regulate symbolic speech, the regulation has to further a government interest, be unrelated to freedom of expression, and be narrowly tailored. Okay, so in this case, O'Brien's burning of the card, the regulation that said he had to have a draft card, was important to the conscription. There are other ways that O'Brien could have expressed his displeasure with the Selective Service Act that were unrelated to free speech, and the rule was narrowly tailored. Okay, so in this case, the conviction was upheld. Generally speaking, I don't tend to test this exact case on tests, but I do think it's important to be aware of it. Okay, here's a case you will see on your exam. It's the RAV case. That gentleman there is Robert A. Victora, not a very nice man. He's a white supremacist. He's currently sitting in jail in Florida, I believe, for unrelated charges. But at the time of this case, he was living in St. Paul, Minnesota. In St. Paul, at the time, as many other schools, churches, cities, counties had a hate speech ordinance that said you couldn't engage in activities that were, created by or encouraged by hate of someone's race, color, creed, religion, or gender, or what I call the Big Five: race, color, creed, religion, gender. RAV was a minor at the time. He lived next door to a family of color in St. Paul. He took a chair, broke it in half, tied the legs together in the form of a cross, stuck it on the black family's lawn, and torched it. He was convicted for trespassing, but the city also decided to throw the hate crimes ordinance at him. Victor's attorneys argued that the hate ordinance singled out five areas of hatred for additional punishment: race, color, creed, religion, gender, and that was content-based. And the Supreme Court agreed. The Supreme Court overturned St. Paul's ordinance. saying you can't single out just five forms of expression for punishment. You've got to be more inclusive in your hate. So, for example, say that Victoria had lived next door to a gay couple and he had burned, you know, a rainbow flag on their lawn. St. Paul could not have used the hate ordinance law to punish him. So this is a content-based regulation. It receives strict scrutiny. And as we understand, that usually means that it fails. Okay? Now, this is a hate speech law. It is not a cross-burning law. We're going to talk about cross-burning in a few slides. But no matter what symbol Victoria had chosen in this case, the city could have applied the same law. Okay. Let's talk about penalty enhancement. Now, this is a case in which additional penalties, additional years in prison, or additional fines are levied against people who engage in hate crimes. And the court has said, generally speaking, that this is okay, even though it's content-based. The case is called Wisconsin versus Mitchell. In this case, several African-American youths had watched the great movie Mississippi Burning. Then they had gone outside, and they were all riled up from the film, and they saw a white kid crossing the street, and they went to beat him up. So they were convicted under assault, and they got additional penalties because it was a hate crime. It was motivated by hatred of race. California has such a law, too. The statute was challenged. They made the same argument as an RAV. Can you really single out just a couple of areas for special attention? And the Supreme Court on this side said yes, saying a physical assault is not by any stretch of the imagination conduct protected by the First Amendment. So in other words, the state is free to impose additional penalties for hate-based crimes, because it manages to meet that strict scrutiny. Now, I personally, if you're thinking, well, RAV and Mitchell are kind of the same case, why did they come out differently? I think you'd be right. I don't think it's quite as easy as the physical assault, but that's the reasoning the court gave us, and it's probably a good a reason as any. Okay? I tend to memorize these cases. I don't see a way in a framework they would fit together. I think that they should have both been turned over or both been upheld, but not one of each. But unfortunately, I'm not sitting on the Supreme Court, so just like you, I have to memorize it. If you've got questions on it, let me know. All right. Let's turn to a symbolic speech case. Symbolic speech, as we said in the O'Brien case, is speech where you don't have to say anything to have expression. So burning a cross, burning a flag, burning a draft card, or in this case, wearing a leather jacket with the words, "fuck the draft" on the back. Okay? Mr. Cohen went in to pay a ticket. Paul Cohen, he went to a California courthouse to pay a parking ticket or something like that. He was wearing a leather jacket with the words painted on the back. And he walked in, he paid his ticket, he turned around to walk out, and he was arrested for disturbing the peace, even though he hadn't disturbed the peace. All he had gone in to do was peacefully pay a ticket. And the Supreme Court said, look, you can't throw the guy in jail just because you don't like the words on his jacket. It's a speech act. He didn't incite any violence. There were just a couple people who were offended by it, and that's not good enough. The court came out with the very famous quote, "One man's vulgarity is another's lyric." So bottom line is, you actually have to disturb the peace before you can be convicted of disturbing the peace with a speech act. All right. Let's turn to flag burning. Flag burning law, flag desecration law, was a big thing back in the early 90s. It's a little bit calmer now. Important case coming out of it is a case called Texas versus Johnson. Came out in 1989. Gregory Lee Johnson stood on the Dallas courthouse steps. Someone handed him a flag. He torched it, and he sang, "America, the red, white, and blue, we spit upon you." And he was arrested under Texas flags desecration statute. Flag desecration statutes, which are still on the books today, they're not supposed to be enforced after this case, but sometimes they are, say that you can't step on the flag or burn it or desecrate it or, you know, harm it in any way. In this case was the case that overturned all those rules. So Gregory Lee Johnson takes the case to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court overturns his conviction. And Justice Brennan writes, if there is a bedrock principle underlying the First Amendment, it is that the government may not prohibit the expression of an idea simply because society finds the idea itself offensive or disagreeable. Now, there are probably those among you who are listening who are veterans, who think that flag burning really is an atrocious thing. I agree with you. I think that when you burn a flag, you're really marginalizing your speech. But the law right now is you are protected if you decide to burn the flag. You don't have to agree with me or the law, you just have to know it. So 48 flag desecration laws and the federal law were all overturned. And every now and then, a constitutional amendment gets brought before the Congress to try to amend the Constitution so that it would forbid flag burning. So far, that hasn't happened. And again, I completely respect your ability to disagree with the way the court has determined this law. I'm not going to ask you, you know, one way or the other. I just need you to know it. All right. For me, cross-burning is a lot more difficult. The Supreme Court kind of came down a similar way. The Supreme Court's bottom line in cross-burning laws is that if you intend to use them to threaten someone, they are not protected. The case is called Virginia versus Black. Mr. Black and his buddies burned a cross and were convicted under the Virginia law. The Supreme Court struck the law down, not because it didn't think that cross-burning is reprehensible and mean, because the Virginia law at the time automatically assumed that if you were going to burn a cross, you necessarily were burning it to intimidate someone. Let me give you an example. If I'm sitting in my office right now, which I am, and I burn a little cross just for myself, now I would never do that because the thought makes me sick to my stomach, but say I did, I'm not really intending to use that cross burning to intimidate anyone. I'm using it to maybe shore up my own sick beliefs. Okay? What the court said was you have to have a way to demonstrate to a jury's satisfaction that the cross burning was intended to intimidate someone. The court wrote, when a burning cross does not inevitably convey a message of intimidation, often the cross burner intends that the recipients of the message fear for their lives. And when a cross burning is used to intimidate, few if any messages are more powerful. The court said a threat actually has to be demonstrated, not just assumed. So if you're standing with a bunch of your buddies in a field, and you burn a cross, and nobody is there to see it, and nobody is intimidated or harmed by that, that's okay. But most of the time, the court said, somebody is going to be threatened by it, because otherwise, why would you do it? The rule is, however, that you actually have to prove the threat. So Barry Black's conviction was overturned, the others were left in place, and the bottom line rule is, if a cross burning is intended to intimidate, it is not protected. Okay. Whoops. Let's turn to funeral protests. Apparently my animations were a little screwed up there. This case is a case that is going to come before the Supreme Court next term. It's called Snyder versus Phelps. There's a group of churchgoers in Westboro that go to the Westboro Baptist Church. I believe it's Kansas. And they're not a very nice group of people. They like to go to soldiers' funerals, soldiers who have been killed in the Iraqi War. They like to go to people's funerals who are killed, who happen to be gay. And they protest these funerals as part of their religious outreach. You can see a picture of them below. That woman in the middle with all the signs around her is Shirley Phelps Roper. She's the daughter of Fred Phelps, who's the minister of this church. And these people, you know, pay their own way. They travel around the country and they protest funerals. And in this case, they protested the funeral of a guy's son who had been killed in Iraq. It's not a very good set of facts for the case, unfortunately. But they were carrying some very ugly signs. God hates the USA. God hates fags, fag troops. They're basically saying that this country, people are dying for this, and we really protect homosexuality, and homosexuality is the root of all evil, and gay people are going to burn in hell. They're not a very nice group of people. But they tend to obey all the laws when they go to protest. Some states have started to pass laws to say that you can't protest any funeral at all for any reason. This case is going to be before the Supreme Court this year. In this case, the Fourth Circuit said that this particular protest, the protest of Mr. Snyder's son, was protected by the First Amendment. The Supreme Court has taken the case to resolve the issue. Kind of a sad set of facts. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about abortion speech. Abortion speech tends to be time, place, and manner driven. Regulations tend to be upheld based on whether or not they are reasonable restrictions on people's speech rights. The cases I'm going to ask you to know for physical protests are Madsen and Schenck. In the Madsen case, there were two regulations that were at issue. There was a 36-foot buffer zone between anti-abortion protesters and people who were seeking access to a clinic, and there were also noise restrictions. Both of those restrictions were upheld because they were applied to everyone equally. No matter what you were protesting, if you were saying, you know, having an abortion is your right, or don't have an abortion because it kills a baby, you had to stand 36 feet away, and you could only be so loud. So because it was treating all speech the same, it was content neutral and therefore upheld. In the Schenck versus Pro-Choice Network case, however, several years later, the court said, well, if it's a fixed buffer zone, it's okay. If you can draw a bright white line on the concrete and say everybody has to stand behind this line no matter what they're saying, that's okay. A floating buffer zone, like stay 5 feet away from any person, is hard to enforce because how do you know what 5 feet away from anybody is? You know, if I spread my arms out, is that 5 feet? And if I walk towards you, am I like carrying a bubble that you have to move back? The rules have to be clear, the court said. And if the rules are clear, then that's a content-neutral regulation, and it's a content-neutral regulation, you're probably okay. All right. Now, here's another kind of depressing case that's on abortion speech, but it's on a website. I've given you a screenshot of the website there. It's called the Nuremberg Files. The whole name of the case is Planned Parenthood of the Columbia Willamette versus American Coalition of Life Activists. I will always call it the Nuremberg Files because that's too much of a case name. This was a website whose screenshot I've given you below that planned for the time in the United States where the founders of the website believe abortion will be illegal. Like the Nuremberg trials after World War II, the individuals who keep the Nuremberg Files website believe that the people who provide abortion services or who work with people who provide abortion services will be eventually prosecuted for crimes against the unborn. So they gather information and, some say, encourage harm against these individuals. So what happened in this case was these individuals were targeted, these abortion doctors were targeted by this Nuremberg Files website. Information about them was put online and encouragement was made to them to try to basically do harm to these people. All right? Let me show you. Here's a screenshot here, and unfortunately it's not a very good screenshot. I didn't get a very good one when the site was active. But if a person was injured, their name was grayed out there like on the top. If someone had been killed, their name was struck through. And if someone was still working, their name was regular. Okay? So a fatality meant that your name was crossed off the list. That was considered by the court to be a threat. Now, some people would argue that simply crossing out a name doesn't really rise to the Brandenburg standard of immediacy. But the Ninth Circuit felt it was important to err on the side of saying that this was not okay to do. Now, if you go to the Nuremberg Files today, it looks something like this, where it says, due to the recent Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision, we have reverted to a version of the Nuremberg Files published without the strike-through lines defined by a hysterical Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals as a true threat. So you can see how they've changed their website, or they had at the time. I haven't been there for a while because I kind of don't like going there. It's kind of creepy to me to see it. They also, however, have a site where they're doing stuff like this, where they're actually identifying an abortionist and all of his personal information, and in a sense, I think, still encouraging. But again, they were fined, I believe, $107 million, which the ACLA people said that they were never going to pay. Pretty distressing, again, set of cases, and it's a difficult set of cases to even think about, because it's very painful. That dripping blood up there and those little screenshots there are supposedly pictures of aborted fetuses. So it's ugly all the way around. Okay. Let's turn to anonymous speech. In the new textbook, I have a whole new section talking about anonymous speech. You won't be able to have that just yet, but there are a couple of cases that I'd like you to know about that are in, you know, most of the books, and that's McIntyre and Cahill. The court has basically said that anonymous speech should be protected. In the McIntyre case, which is the lead case from the Supreme Court on this, Mrs. McIntyre was not a very likable person. You've got friends like that where they have good ideas, but they're not very socially skilled at putting those ideas out. Or maybe you've got a coworker like that where you say, you know, you've got a great idea, but let me bring it to the boss, because every time you bring it to the boss, we never get it passed, even though it's a great idea. Court in the same way here, Mrs. McIntyre was not a very popular person. Ohio had a law at the time that said all pamphlets had to be signed. And so what the court did in this case was said, anonymity is a shield from the tyranny of the majority. They struck down the Ohio law that said all political pamphlets had to be signed. And the court said, anonymity is a tyranny, shield from the tyranny of the majority. In other words, anonymous speech is just as protected as speech whose speaker is known. I'll say that again. Anonymous speech is just as protected as speech whose speaker is known. One of the hottest areas of law right now is whether and when to unmask an anonymous speaker for purposes of suing them for libel. You've probably been on websites where anonymous speakers are attacking each other. Sometimes people want to sue for libel on that. The cases that have been developing have basically relied on this case, which is the Doe versus Cahill case. It's a Delaware Supreme Court case, and it comes out of the Delaware Supreme Court. There was a councilman, Delaware City Councilman named Patrick Cahill, who wanted to sue an anonymous commentator for libel for accusing him of basically being incompetent. So he asked Comcast, who was the online service provider, who notified the blogger that the blogger was going to be unmasked, and the blogger got a restraining order to stop his name from being revealed. The court basically said, look, if you're going to unmask an anonymous source, you have to have a case. All right? You actually have to say, my libel suit is likely to succeed, or I have a good chance of getting a jury to agree with me before you can get the name of someone to sue. You can't just willy-nilly ask for people's, you know, real names because of McIntyre, where the court has protected anonymous speech. Now, the Supreme Court has never heard an anonymous blogger case, all right? But this case at the lower court, it's a state Supreme Court level, has been the case that most circuits and most other states are relying on to determine whether to unmask an anonymous speaker. So the bottom line rule is you have to have a case, a good case, before the court will let you find out who to sue. Okay. Now, hitman case, another kind of creepy case. I want you to set down your pencils for a minute if you're taking notes. I'm going to tell you a little story. Once upon a time, there was a family who lived, I believe, in Maryland, but don't mark me on that. Mom, dad, and baby. Now, when baby was born, baby had some sort of health problems, and the hospital screwed up on the baby's anesthesia, and the baby was left without oxygen for a while, and the baby developed brain damage as a result. So the hospital paid out a malpractice claim that set the mom, the dad, and the baby up in a house and actually had a nurse there to take care of the child, all paid for under malpractice. Mom and dad eventually get a divorce, and so mom takes the baby and the nurse and is living in the house with the malpractice money. Dad falls on hard times. Dad thinks, huh, mom and baby have all this money. If I off mom and baby, I can get that money for myself. So dad hires a hitman. The hitman buys the book that is shown in the upper corner there, the hitman book, to basically teach him how to do the hit. And the book has information about, you know, how to make a scope and how to check out the place to be able to get in and out, where to stand. And there was evidence that the hitman used all the directions when he went into the house and he killed the mom, the baby, and the nurse by following the instructions in the book Hitman. He was arrested and the father was arrested. Surviving family members sued Paladin Press, who published the book Hitman, for basically encouraging and teaching the person how to do the hit. The Fourth Circuit took the case, and essentially said, you know, this is a lot like Brandenburg. It's not just instructions on how to make a silencer. That might be protected. But this book is an incitement. It's a training manual for assassins, and it is an incitement. It unmistakably urges concrete violation of the laws against murder and murder for hire. And the Supreme Court has never protected as abstract advocacy speech so explicit in its palpable entreaties to violent crime. In other words, the Fourth Circuit said, you know, we're going to let this suit go forward because we believe that this is like an incitement. When you're holding this book in your hand, you're not just getting instructions. You have a cheering squad behind you saying, you go do it. All right? The Soldier of Fortune case is another case. But let me show you some of the quotes from Hitman. After killing your first victim, you felt absolutely nothing. You are shocked by that nothingness. You had expected this moment to be a spectacular point in your life. You had wondered if you would feel compassion for the victim, immediate guilt, or even experience direct intervention by the hand of God. But you weren't even feeling sickened by the sight of the body. And then this last quote, which is the clincher to me. After you have arrived home, the events that took place take on a dreamlike quality. You don't dwell on them. You don't worry. You don't have nightmares. You don't fear ghosts. By the time you collect the balance of your contract fee, the doubts and fears of discovery have faded. Those feelings have been replaced by cockiness, a feeling of superiority, and new independence and self-assurance. They're basically saying, when you kill somebody, you're going to feel so good. It's better than chocolate, better than a steak, better than sex, better than everything. When you read this book, one of the first semesters I taught this case, a student bought the book on eBay and brought it in. And when you read this book, when you hold it in your hands, you feel dirty. Because it really is saying, you're going to be so awesome when you kill somebody. So go out and do it right now. Now, I have a real tough time with protecting speech like this. And fortunately for me, the case settled before the Supreme Court actually had to come in and say, we're not going to protect it. Interestingly, the person who wrote this book, whose pen name is Rex Farrell, you can see it on the front cover there, is actually just a housewife. And she was interviewed behind closed doors. She had signed a contract with the publisher saying that if anything happens out of this book, I'm not responsible. It's called indemnification. The publisher takes all the responsibility, not the author. So you've got to wonder, well, if she signed a contract, maybe she thought there was something going on here. Why would you do that? Okay? And secondly, of course, this woman said, I got all the information by simply reading books in the library and watching TV. It all should be protected speech. Another hard case that actually settled before the Supreme Court ever had to step in. Now, about the Soldier of Fortune case, I'll show you real quick. Same kind of concept here. The family sued a magazine that advocated, that provided an ad for a person who was going to do hits for hire, and the jury awarded the family a bunch of money for a wrongful death. All right. A little bit about the First Amendment and the arts. That woman at the top there is a woman named Karen Finley. Karen Finley is a performance artist. And one of the things she liked to do was get naked on stage, smear her body with chocolate, and talk about murder. Sort of an odd girl. But she had been getting funding from a federal organization called the National Endowment of the Arts. It's a government organization that provides money for funding the arts. She received money, and then the government cut her off because it said, basically, we don't want to provide money for you to get naked on stage and smear your body with chocolate. We think that we should uphold general standards of decency. She sued, and she said, look, you're censoring me. And the Supreme Court said, no, they're not. You can continue to go on stage and smear your body with chocolate. The government doesn't have to pay for it. So a lack of funding does not equal censorship. Now, other forms of art is one that I've showed you below. That happens to be Serrano, a guy named Andre Serrano, and the piece of art, quote-unquote, is called Piss Christ. That is a portrait of a crucifix submerged in the artist's own urine. Now, whether or not we should protect this as art is one question. Whether we should give it money from the government to provide funding for that kind of art is another question. The court cut off Serrano's fees as well, but the Supreme Court has basically said, look, you can continue to make any kind of art you want. We just aren't going to fund it. What has also happened in the area of pit bull fighting is an animal cruelty law, which, you know, some people would say that videotapes are a form of art too. Supreme Court has struck down a law just this past year in a case called U.S. versus Stevens. The law was passed against what's called crush videos. Crush videos are apparently sexually themed videos. I've never actually seen one, where women wear high heels and crush small animals while talking baby talk to them. Really pretty gross. But it was applied to a guy selling pit bull fighting videos. The Supreme Court overturned the law as overbroad, but said you could probably pass a law that would be okay. It just isn't this one. Okay. Couple of other cases on the names of rape victims. Some students talk about, you know, whether or not we should reveal the names of rape victims. For those of you who have had a media ethics class or who plan to, that's a question for the media ethics class. Most news organizations have made the decision not to publish the names of rape victims. But if they are lawfully obtained, news organizations are permitted to release them. And there are two cases that say that, actually several cases that say that. The Cox case and the Florida Star case. In the Cox case, the reporter got the name of a rape victim from court records. Public information, it was published on TV. She sued, the rape victim sued, and the court said, well, you know, you can't really punish the media for publishing something that is in the public. In the Florida Star case, the reporter copied a victim's name from a police press room. The police hadn't intended to release it, and the name was accidentally released in the paper. She sued, she won, but the court overturned it, basically saying, again, the information was obtained lawfully. Now, that's an important legal concept that we will see several times. If the information is lawfully obtained by the media may publish it. That was true in the Pentagon Papers case, where the information was obtained legally by the New York Times and the Washington Post. They didn't sneak in and steal it. Someone leaked it to them. And it's true in these rape victim cases, too. Now, again, this is not a suggestion that media organizations should publish rape victims' names. They are simply permitted to if they obtain those names legally. Most news organizations choose not to. Here is the major concepts of this chapter. And thanks for your time.